Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. Investments. Complicated? Not when you talk to a financial broker about a Zurich investment plan.
Tweet at Drive Time RTE.
President Bill Clinton, good evening.
Good evening.
What are your thoughts today when you heard the news of John Hume's passing?
First of all, I've said a brief prayer of gratitude for his life. He was a remarkable man. And, you know, he had his health struggles for the last several years, and he and Pat bore them, as they bore everything else, with dignity and the best humor they could muster. And I just wish him a peaceful rest. He was a remarkable man who would have been very valuable to the world at full steam these last two or three years, when all over the world people were celebrating divisive characters, people who treated their political opponents as less than human and had no respect for anybody else and seemed to be rewarded for it in certain circles. And John was the very opposite of that. He was a determined advocate for peace in Northern Ireland, but he would deal with anyone who was duly elected and try to win them over. And that's sort of out of fashion today, but I think it's going to come back in fashion, because everywhere in the world we've been treated to this sort of thing and hasn't worked out very well.
Was he just an interlocutor, or was he also a friend?
Oh, no, he became a friend. You couldn't help befriending him. Particularly, it was easy for me because I shared his goals, you know, and we wanted to get to a peace agreement. But I also appreciated the fact that he had fought so long and so hard and still managed to be a real person with a real life. And he knew perfectly well that if the SDLP succeeded and then people would be a little bit afraid of it, and it would tend to be, then both communities would tend to elect people who take a harder line than his party did. And he knew there would be a political cost, but it paled him. It was as nothing to the goal of giving the children of Northern Ireland a peaceful future. I just admired him. And I liked him, and he was good company. I loved being with him.
When you were elected in 1993, Northern Ireland was in a very, very dark place. And politically, there would have been as many reasons, frankly, to give Northern Ireland a wide berth on your part. But you didn't. You engaged with it. I'm wondering, was John Hume the key persuader there? Was it him and his enthusiasm for the idea of a peace process that won you over?
Well, I think what he won on was, excuse me, that's my dog in the background.
We heard.
What he won on was how we engaged. I wanted to do it from the beginning because I had been interested in the troubles since they started when I was a student in England. And I had been heavily influenced by the Irish community in America, who very much wanted America to do more. But when we got into the doing part, I realized that it was his counsel I needed to rely on, because the United States could never be more than an honest broker, which is what he tried to do by bridging the divides in the North. And so I studied everything I could about his career and what he had done and how he had managed through the hard times. And it convinced me that if the United States took the position of rigorously supporting a nonviolent, peaceful solution to this that was fair to everybody, we might actually be able to play a positive role. And he was the image of that for me.
nonetheless, it was a very risky enterprise for you, which could have gone awry at any stage, in the political consequences would have been very, very bad for you. I'm wondering, what was it about him that persuaded you to actually say, yes, all right, we'll commit to this?
Well, first of all, he exuded goodness and conviction. And secondly, it just made sense. I thought it was worth the risk. I mean, if you're never going to take any risk, you shouldn't take one of these jobs. I mean, people hire you to solve problems and to seize opportunities. And it can't always be a popular thing to do. In the short run, you have to take some steps that may not be popular. You have to take some risks. But in the end, you gamble that there's something basically good about people and something basically sane. And if you can be good and sane and persistent, for all of his good nature, he was persistent as could be. You have to do that. And every time I saw him, I felt this great tide of admiration and affection and enjoyment of his company, but it also inspired me to just keep going. I thought, you know, we need to do this. This is the face that the Irish presents to the world. And I think I always thought the North would be better off getting along than continuing to fight, and I still believe that.
Earlier on, we heard Tony Blair say that while John Hume was obviously the leader of a political party and the head of his own negotiation team in the Good Friday Agreement talks, he thought of him as being somehow slightly independent, if not perhaps above the fray. I wonder, did you look upon him the same way?
I did, but he was above the fray in a way, but he sure knew when to get involved. I mean, I took all that heat for giving Jerry Adams a visa, you remember?
Yeah.
But he thought it was time. He said, I think it's worth the risk. Said it might not work out, but I think you ought to do it. Now, that had a real impact on me. Because, you know, at the time, the then British government was going crazy. My own State Department was against it. And I thought, here's John Hume, who had stood up for nonviolence throughout the entire length of the Troubles, saying, time to take a leap of faith.
You were the right president at the right time for the island of Ireland, certainly. I wonder, though, were you conscious when you were arriving in the White House that John Hume had built this very extensive, very influential network of senior politicians throughout Washington, and that whoever came into the White House at that time in 1993, 1994, was going to come under immense pressure?
Well, I became aware of it quite quickly because of, you know, I was working with Congress to try to, we had such a heavy congressional agenda when I became president because we were determined to completely change the
Hello, Mr. President. Can you
hear
us?
I was in regular contact with all of them, and you'd be amazed how many times I would talk to Tom Foley, the speaker, or any number of members of the House of Representatives or senators, and they bring up Ireland, too. We talk about Ireland. And almost always they took the point of view of John.
There have been many moments throughout the course of the reconciliation here and the working out of this peace process that would make the hair stand up on the back of your neck. But there's one moment in particular that stands out for many people, and that's your visit with Mrs. Clinton to the Guildhall Square in Derry. What are your memories of that day?
Oh, I remember it so vividly. First of all, you know, John had told me that I needed to come to Derry for reasons that were obvious. And I remember wondering what the reception would be, what the mood would be. And when I got there and I saw the square was full, then all the streets leading down to the square were full for several blocks back. And that's when I knew, in a way, in the end, it was going to happen, even that early. I remember so well Phil Coulter singing "The Town I Love So Well" and looking at the eyes of the people in the crowd. And they wanted a different future. They wanted it. You could just see it. And it was chilling. I still think of it often. It was one of the most moving moments that I experienced as president.
Is Northern Ireland the single lasting achievement of your foreign agenda?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't go that far. There were a lot of other things that happened that were very big and important. But I kept using Northern Ireland, for example, as an example for the Colombians, trying to get them to make peace. I tried to tell Yasser Arafat that he ought to take the peace agreement that I offered at the end, because you had to share the future. That's what the model of the agreement that George Mitchell worked out with all of our partners, including John, the model is what the future has to be about. You're either going to share the future or treat it like a pie. You're going to divide up. And it, in a way, you could argue that it was most important because it was a model for many of the other successes that occurred. And a cautionary tale, look what happened in the Middle East. They turned down a great deal, and 20 years later, there's still no agreement.
And would you and John Hume ever talk about any of those other peace processes? Did you ever consult them on them?
Oh, yes. We certainly did. You know, when we had some personal time, he and Pat came over to see me once when I was in the Irish Republic giving a little talk, and I always saw him when I was in the North, and we would talk about how elements of the Good Friday Accord, once we settled on them, were basically a roadmap that could be adapted virtually everywhere. I tried to solve the difficulties the Greeks and Turks had with Cyprus by arguing for an amendment to that, something that would look like the Northern Irish deal, apply their circumstances. And so we talked about it a lot, because I really did believe, once I saw that it could command a majority vote in both communities and the enthusiastic support of the Irish Republic and the UK government, I thought, you know, this is what we ought to try to do, some version of this, and all these other troubled places around the world. And I still believe that. I've been like a fish out of water these last few years, because I just don't agree with all this separatist nationalism. I think we should all be nationalists. We should all be proud of our national and ethnic and religious heritage. But to say we're better than someone else and we have to live apart from them is a loser in the world we're living in.
Sorry, go on. I interrupted you.
No. So anyway, we talked about this a lot. Once we got to be, you know, friends and relaxed around each other, we would talk about it. And then, of course, after I left office, I kept up and tried to keep the peace process moving along as well as I could as a private citizen supporting it. And I continue to see John over the years and talk about it.
Because we have had John Hume on our landscape for so long, we're perhaps a little bit blasé about him and what he means. But there's a, perhaps a symmetry in him passing at the same time as John Lewis is buried in the United States. Are those two figures, two men that you would think of in the same way, Mr. President?
Yeah, it's interesting you should say that, because I woke up this morning thinking about him, John Lewis and John Hume. And they were quite a lot alike. They also were, John Lewis was beaten within an inch of his life on more than one occasion, and is a genuine hero, but he never stopped treating other people like people. He never stopped trying to find common ground, even as he stood up for what he believed in a polarizing and violent environment in the beginning for quite a long while. So I think there are many, many similarities.
Indeed. President Bill Clinton, thank you very much for your time and for that tribute to the late John Hume. You're very good.
It's an honor. Thanks for talking. Thanks.
Goodbye.